Observers have often commented on how Burma is a land of contrasts, where various narratives often diverge, conflict, and even contradict each other. History, culture, and identity are layered with nuance, and just as no single personal story can capture the full picture from the ground, no single analyst or academic can adequately weave together the full tale from up above either. Yet, amid these differences, there exists this profound possibility that we can create a space where even apparently competing versions of the truth can coexist, intertwine, even enrich each other. At Insight Myanmar, we aim to create a space where these overlapping realities are acknowledged, explored, and honored. We believe that understanding one truth does not require the dismissal of another, but instead calls for an openness to hold multiple perspectives at once. This means listening to the truth of one community while recognizing the validity of another, or grappling with the weight of historical injustices in one place while celebrating the courage to move forward in another. By engaging simultaneously with these complex and sometimes uncomfortable layers, we hope to foster a dialogue that reflects a fuller spectrum of Myanmar's lived experiences, a dialogue rooted not in opposition, but in shared humanity. Join us in the journey that follows.
My name is Sat Du Nan and Zeng Hang. My native name is Du Nan Zeng Hang, and my American name is Zach. Yeah. Mm.
Thank you, Zach, for joining us from Insight Myanmar podcast. We're speaking in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, where you have lived for 7 years, and your journey of coming from a very small village, as I understand, a hut and a rice field, where you were born in 1994, from the journey from there through Yangon, Brown University, and then eventually in the Netherlands. It's quite a story to tell. And so let's kick that story off and tell us about your earliest memories from that hut in the rice field in Kachin State.
Oh, I was born there in a rice field because my parents were running away from the actually Burmese military as well, because in my region, during that time, they did all sort of things. You know, you heard about the Burmese military's brutality, so like they were running, and then why my parents were settling in a rice field, and I was born there. I don't have any recollection of that specific area because I was very young, but I had a childhood memory where I grew up. It's like one village away from our original home, so yeah.
Mm, right, and so then, what are your earliest memories, and how would you describe your life growing up?
Growing up in a village for me is in Kachin region, near China border. It's called Luijie. I'm not sure if you've been to Maijiayang, Luijie, that area. Mm-hmm. So my village is farther down from the Luijie. Luijie is a Burmese control area, and my area where I grew up is KIA area or non-governmental area. You know, KIA was also not affected, you know, any system anyway. I grew up in a village without electricity to, you know, farmer parents. I would say most of the time when I tell about my childhood and my birthplace, people associate immediately to poverty because, like, electricity, you know, like village mean poverty, like they automatically assume that we don't have anything to eat, but that was not the case. because my parents were farmers, so food were never, you know, scarcity in our household, and abundance of foods and fruits and vegetables yearly and seasonally. So that's my,
How would you describe Kachin cooking?
Kachin cooking is very different from Burmese and the rest of the country, because we live in a mountain with very limited contact to the, you know, like city and the machinery and the factory. So we use very little oil, because to get oil we have to go to China, you know, to go into Chinese territory, and then to get the products and goods from there for our, you know, like maybe once a month the market happened, or once a week like that. So we had to get oil, and it's a very scarce there. So like we use very little oil and a lot of natural ingredients that are available in the region. So Kachin food is very delicious and also very healthy, and not like so oily, this kind of stuff, very different from Burmese.
Yes, it is very different. And for those who've been in Burma, they know that how oily Bamar food is. When I lived in Yangon, there was a Kachin restaurant in Kendaji Park I used to go to. And another one that was, I'm trying to remember where it was. It was in a different place, but a couple different Kachin places I would go to that I just thought the food was so delicious, and unlike any, as you say, unlike any other Bamar or ethnic food that I had in the country.
Different from Karen and Chin people and other people, because like our region is very fertile, so we have all sorts of vegetation and, you know, herbs and a lot of things that you can just get naturally. I would say a little bit similar to Yunnan region as well, because we also, I'm from the Zaiwa tribe, so there are a lot of Zaiwa people in China and India as well. So we are the same. So China has, in that Yunnan region, we share similar cuisine.
Interesting. So your first language was Zaiwa. Tell us what linguistic family this is in, and then what languages you went on to learn after.
I think our language is family from Sino-Tibetan. My first mother tongue is Zaiwa, and then when I grew up, I had to go to church, and then KIA govern school, so I had to learn Jingpo. Zaiwa is pretty similar to kind of Tibetan. When I was in the refugee camp in the Netherlands here, and I had never met any Tibetan before, and I saw Zaiwa looking like person, this uncle, let's say, and I was 100% sure that he was Zaiwa, and I went to talk to him in Zaiwa language, and then he had no clue what I was talking about. And then I asked him, where are you from? And then he said, from Tibet. And then like the way they communicate, like the vowel and, you know, the pronunciations are very similar to my Zaiwa language, but we don't understand each other at all. So,
And is there any relation between Zaiwa, which is, I understand, a Kachin tribe, and Jingpa, which is the main Kachin language? Are those linguistically related?
I don't think so, but some of them, like Zaiwa and Lechik, are, 30% mutual understanding each other. But with Jingpo, there's not at all, you know. And for us, also in Kachin, we had to learn our common language to be able to communicate with each other as well. So.
So you go from your mother tongue, your tribal tongue, Zaiwa, into the regional tongue of Jingpa, And then when you're in sixth grade, you then go to public school and then have to learn Burmese, correct?
Yes. Yeah. In Jingpo, in Kachin, KIA government school, we also learn what you call Burmese, like alphabet or the curriculum are the same, but we never, the instruction, you know, the language by the teacher were Jingpo. So like, I never knew how to speak Burmese, but I understand it, but I didn't know how to speak. So when I was in like grade 7, that's the first time I really forced myself to speak, you know, the Burmese for the first time in Loiche, yeah.
All right, so then as, I also wonder how this relates to understanding your identity, because I would expect that in Kachin community, you're something of a minority being Zaiwa, and then in Bamar urban places where there's a Bamar majority, you're obviously a minority being Kachin or Kachin subset. So how did you come to understand this identity?
I grew up like being Zaiwa or being Lichik or Ruang, you know, like it's just, we are like just brothers with Jingpo people. So that's how we understand each other. So I didn't really feel like a minority among Kachin. So we are always together. Like we have very strong kinship with each other. So like seven brothers, you know, so just from the same family. So I didn't really feel like a minority. But the first time I felt I was different is like among the Burmese people. And then in the Loiche is a border with China. So like there are a lot of people from different ethnicity, like Shan people, Chinese people, but Myanmar citizenship, national. So there is the first time I was really mixed with many people and really had to force myself to learn and conform into Burmese standard or so, yeah.
What was that like?
When you were young, but you don't really recognize what you are being forced into because like you thought it was just normal, but you know, like now looking back, like it's not really normal, you know, because they take the Burmese culture as the norm and the standard by default and without really asking our culture context or background. For example, like I have this issue still, and I'm very hurt about it, you know, and sour about it, because like we Kachin people, everybody has a family name, because that's how we have, you know, like the bond between the kinships are introduced. The first time we introduce each other, we introduce ourselves by the family name, so that we are either brothers or like I can marry your daughter, or I have to give my daughter to your son, you know, this kind of triangle kinship system that we have. But Burmese people, they don't have family names. So like when I enroll in the school, they just, remove my last name. Ooh. And then until now, it was become only Du Nan, and then my Zinghang is completely removed, because for the Burmese teacher, it was so difficult to pronounce and also to write Zinghang. They can write it in Zinghang, so they had to write Zinghan, this kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting because a lot of Burmese people will complain that when they're filling out applications anywhere outside of Burma, they're forced to put a last name, and it doesn't respect their culture and their naming system of how they don't have last names, and they're kind of forced to put different names in different categories that don't really make sense to their language and culture and family. And yet you're describing the same thing where then the Bamar is the majority, and then they're forcing other ethnicities to fit into a standardized system of naming that doesn't really relate to their backgrounds.
I think like if we have to talk about that, it's a lot of emotional as well, because like story is just not like a story, but it's a lived experience, you know. A lot of Burma people who grew up under the Burmanization, you know, like Burma by default, they don't even have to question themselves about, you know, their existence or their culture encroaching on other people or domineering on other people, that they never had to question themselves. So for me, I had to adjust from the early age, and it still caused a lot of problem here now. Sometimes I can't book Airbnb because I don't have last name in the Netherlands, also by Western standard, is a last name is a, you know, required to do all the paperwork. Sometimes I can withdraw money from the bank, and now if I have to put my last name here in the Netherlands in my ID, I had to pay like 1,000 euros with the help of lawyers. So a lot of extra complicated, you know, all this little stupid thing that can really have effect on your identity and your daily life as well.
I can understand that. I mean, just some very small anecdotal example. When I was flying out here to Europe, they somehow booked my ticket wrong so that instead of my first, middle, and last name, they had booked my middle and last name as one name. And so all of the letters and the names were correct, but they had combined a last name by the middle and the last. And it was so complicated, just that little, because airline security procedures, it was so complicated that I had to have a gate escort through security and talk to different security officers to, and I was afraid I wasn't going to be able to fly out, just because they had combined two names into one, even though the passport showed exactly what it was and it was obvious. So, you know, even just that small anecdotal example for, you know, for those that don't fit into the normal nomenclature of names and standards, international standards, I could just imagine it's another layer.
I don't want to bog you down with all this detail, boring information. But one thing that also really, what you call, stand out for me is that I remember that we Inuit people have like very strange, according to Burmese standard, right, name. And then like we always used to get bullied by our name, because like my Dunan is very beautiful, well thought out traditional name in my culture and in my language, but Dunan in Burmese literally translate to like, for example, when you cook and the cook is burned and become char black, and then it smells. So like Dubi Nanda, that I used to get taste all the time and bully, and not just me, my cousin who are with, you know, like, for example, Moon Molly is also very beautiful, female name related to the moon and this kind of stuff. And then Burmese people will call her Moon Bolly. Bolly is like a woman's, you know, what is this?
Breast.
Breastwear.
The bra.
The bra, yes. This kind of stuff. So Inuit people get this kind of, you know, not fitting in, and I hated my name. I asked my parents, like, why did you name me such an ugly name? You know, like, I wanted to change so much my name since I was young.
That's interesting. So, I mean, to make these identity issues even more complicated for you, because you're talking about coming from this minority culture to a majority dominated country and trying to fit in, but then you also had your identity issues within that minority culture, because you began to question the religion and sexual orientation, which further complicated your sense of identity. So tell us about those journeys.
I think like I had a quite a rough childhood, I guess. Like I'm now like now in the West and safe, and also getting education in the Western standard. So I was feeling it back then, but I couldn't really pinpoint and name exactly what it is. You know, like I am like minority among minority as an intersection minority. For example, I also recently just came out as a gay to my parents and to my community. So for me, growing up was really tough as well, because like I get bullied because I am Jingpo or Zaiwa among the Burma community. They call us like mountain people. Tongpo, that is very derogative name, like hillbilly. Tongpo, hillbilly. And then like among my community, among my own people as well, because I was, when I was young, I was very, you know, like dramatic and flamboyant and very, I thought I was a girl, you know, until somebody, when I go to the school, and then the teacher started to, you know, like very strict, right? You know, in Myanmar, how it works, like the boy has to wear the boy's uniform, green and white, and no tanaka, and then this and that, you know, you have to sit with the boy, you know, girls, and then they started to separating you like that. And then like I knew that I couldn't hang out with girls anymore, I couldn't go to toilet with the girls anymore. So like I was also constantly bullied in the school for many reasons, you know, so, yeah.
Mm. How early were you aware of your sexual orientation?
I think, that is very, I think people who, especially Myanmar people or my people, religious people, don't really think about sexuality. If I had to ask you, if I answer that question, then when did you realize that you are straight, you know? Do you have a specific moment for that in your life? Probably not. No.
Right. Oh, yeah. are you asking me?
I'm asking you, when do you realize that when you're straight, you know, in earliest memory?
If you're asking me, I think it would be from the earliest moments that adolescence came about, and I mm-hmm. started to realize what an attraction was to the opposite sex, and when I felt the first early stages of attraction, it was to the opposite sex. So mm-hmm. that would be what it was.
I think that is very straightforward for you, but for us it's very different, because I knew that I didn't to play with trucks or guns mm-hmm. when I was a baby. You know, my mom bought me and my parents bought me those kind of toys, and I didn't like mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. I just wanted dolls and, you know, Barbies, and want to play with the girls, those kind of stuff. And I didn't like boys because I always find them stupid or doing naughty mm-hmm. stuff, you know, always rough, you know, mm-hmm. Hurting themselves or hurting mm-hmm. others. So I didn't like them. But what you said about the puberty, when it hit, it was also very confusing for me, because mm. I never knew that until university that men and men can fall in love and get married and also have sex, you know. So I didn't know that, but my attraction was always towards men, but I didn't know that, you know. And then being told that you will go to hell, you know, homosexual, this kind of Bible teaching, then it is ingrained in your brain, then you are really finding your primal instinct, you know, to cover mm-hmm. up. And then I wandered into, you know, having relationship with girls or having a crush on girls. But back then, I think I felt genuine, but I think love does not have genders or colors, but, you know, the chemistry is really, you know, telling that which gender and which sex you want, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Right. So, there's a lot there. And when you're describing your childhood of, I actually identify with some of the things you say, because I've, although my sexual orientation might be one thing, my identity as a male has never been one of masculinity. And I think after I graduated college, I went to Japan and spent some time. And I just remember feeling how refreshing it was to be around Japanese men and Asian men mm-hmm. who were completely comfortable in their identity as men and even as straight men, but didn't have to constantly prove this masculinity and constantly have to have this cover. Yeah. And when I would spend years in Japan and then go back to America, I would just feel like every young American male I met was just ramped up on having to show that they were more masculine than the next, and it was just exhausting. And so this sense of, you know, realizing that there's another way to be a man in the world, or in my case, a straight man in the world, and that your lack of masculinity, or your disinterest or even discomfort with masculinity doesn't impact your identity as a man and as a full man, mm-hmm. you know, that was something that I never got growing up, and always felt kind of like a lacking.
I think that you mentioned, you know, the West and the East mm-hmm. and this kind of stuff. Also in my culture, we have to compare. Now I live here in the West for 7 years, so I kind of get to see what the Western culture it is. Quite an irony, you know, you can be anything you want here, you know, free liberal country. With human rights and tolerance, but the gender category here is so strict and very binary. For example, men to men, people who don't show affection or physical contact or, you know, hugging each other, even in friendship, because if you do that, it is so stigmatized here that, are you gay? You know, this kind of stuff, homo, you know, in Dutch also. But in Myanmar, if you are peers, you would see people, you know, shoulder to shoulder hugging and just walking along. like that. And also, you know, there is no stigma, but there is homophobia, you know, but I'm seeing a comparison from two cultures now, you know, how each one functioned very differently. Yeah.
It reminds me of a story I heard years ago about American officers training Iraqi military after the Iraq invasion. And they were talking about their training. At one point, the officer mentioned how annoyed he was that in the training and classes, sometimes the Iraqi soldiers would be holding hands as they had the lessons. Yeah, they weren't gay, but they would be holding hands, because in many cultures, and you know, India certainly and others, holding hands with a male friend is just simply a sign of friendship. And in Burma, same thing. And that he just had this feeling that as your vocation as a soldier, that you shouldn't be having this gesture of like holding hands with another man, because it went outside of his constructs of what a soldier was. This had nothing to do with sexuality. This was, again, this is just the masculinity of even of straight men, that you have a masculinity you have to show and you have to portray. But what you're saying also about Netherlands, I think, would come as a surprise to many, because Netherlands really has a reputation of being just an extremely liberalized and open place.
The first country in the world, you know, to legalize the same-sex marriage, but it's also the same here. But I'm judging which culture is bad or, you know, better or, you know, good or bad. But I'm just seeing the comparison. You know, I'm lucky that I have, you know, this kind of both worldviews. Yeah,
certainly,
I would say. Yeah, how could be so harmful, you know, like if you are in a squad with camaraderie, that you're going to die for each other, like you're forbidden to hold hand with each other, you know. That's quite ironic, right?
Yeah, right. So then through your development, as you started to learn about your yourself and contrasting the society that you were in, understand what was possible in the world for a man to do. You referenced that, I think it was just recently that you came out, so it sounds like it was a long journey to get to this point.
In Myanmar, like, it is a whole story. About LGBT is also quite taboo, and if I had to look closer, like, there is also a difference between Burmese community, how they view LGBT people, and my Christian community, how they view LGBT is very different. In my community, we are more strict, you know, like very intolerant, I would say. My mom still cannot accept me and believe that I should get married with a man, and because she loved me so much, and the last thing she want me is to go to hell, you know. So she couldn't really reconcile this logic in her own as well. So the church, you know, the community sometimes can be very, you know, like lonely for the LGBT people, and being ostracized and being named labels and not taken seriously. And then among the Burmese people, what I noticed, like in the, you know, like when the democracy for a short-lived moment, Burmese people were more accepting of the this kind of people, because like in their culture and in their religion, like these people are just you know, like fulfilling their karma, that what they did wrong or rape, whatever, you know, in the past life. That's why they're now in this life, you know, in between this kind of thing. So they have this kind of religious you know, solutions in their ideology or religion, but in Christianity is a straightforward, you know, hell and heaven. There was no in between for us, so it was more difficult for me.
And there's the nat mediums, which are outside normal relationships, but at least they give some
space,
kind of
and some space to where you're respected and you have a function in the society. In my Christian community, that is not at all, you know. But it also depends on how far we go back, because our people were not Christian. For example, we had Christianity less than 100 years or so because of the American missionary. So our Kachin people were enemies animism or worshipper. So back then we had this we believe that like each person has a soul, a male soul or a female soul. Someone up in between would be a person with two souls, you know, both female energy and male energy. So this kind of thing I'm discovering slowly about my Kachin heritage and animism culture, our ancestral ways of practices, you know. So I'm able to reconnect this kind of lost identity, but it's for me still a discovery journey that I have to search, and it will be visible in my future documentary, hopefully, as well, over that topic. Yeah.
This sounds like a fascinating topic, but also one that would be very challenging to research. So how are you going about that research?
For me now, it's not about research or topic, you know, which specific topic like that. But for me, it will be more like first self-healing and self-discovery journey, because I want to rediscover my and reconnect with my ancestry, spiritual, you know, spirituality, animism, and how we, our culture, you know, like were decoded, you know, by this anthropologist and missionaries, people, and then re-engineer our whole identity, our whole culture, everything changed, you know, into this Western brought religion into Christianity. So I feel like I have been also colonized in a way without even knowing. So I'm not only discovering, so I'm also learning more about decolonization and other indigenous people's struggles around the world, this kind of thing. So trying to find my roots back. And it's also a big taboo gonna be, because like now I come out as a gay person among the Kachin people, and it's very unheard of as well. And I had a lot of backlash also, yeah, on Facebook. I make a blog video about it and this kind of stuff, especially from the Christian people, very mean comments. And like now if I said I wanted to go back to animism and I want to worship Nut is our language, just like not in Burmese as well, spirit. So it will be a big resistance and taboo for me as well. And sometimes I find it very suffocating or restricting to really do that. You know, at the same time, I don't want to hold on to the identity that were firstly given to us. You know?
That's so interesting, and there's so much there. And it's I'm also wondering if is there. Are you finding any other like-minded people, or is there a movement, or is there a sense of others within your community to want to reclaim this pre-Christian animist identity of the Kachin people?
Up until now, because now I'm also in the Netherlands and still studying, and I don't meet any person that is like-minded. Of course, I meet academic friends and students and other people, but there are some of them are very firmly believing in Christianity and about this monotheism, you know. But for me, but we don't fight over it, but you know, like, because we are, you know, open-minded with each other, so we tolerate each other. But up until now, I haven't. But if somebody listen to this podcast and want to, you know, like, they're either working on this field or want to work with me in visual documentary or, you know, in any other form, I would love to. Up until now, I haven't found anyone, so I feel actually quite lonely in this journey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you referenced before how the American missionaries came a little over 100 years ago to spread Christianity among the Kachin people, and you referenced that as the way you described that it was 100 years was like well this just happened recently. There's this whole other background of who we are that has been erased by a relatively new development of Christianity coming. And so I wonder if you can go into more detail about unpacking more what you meant by that statement.
For me, because like 100 years or what, you know, like, because when I, in my family, only three generations has been, my grandpa's father was still not worshippers. They were the first, you know, in our family to convert into Christianity. So I heard about their stories through my father's and my grandmother. So, for example, like my mom, oh, this is so horrible. Like the way we have been indoctrinated, you know, like everything has changed. The way we practice marriage ceremony and funerals and monopoly, you know, do you know that? Monopoly is like our biggest festival, Kachin festival, where you have all these manure columns planted in the middle of the big, you know, plain, and then everybody, we have the leader that dance in front, our community leader or each, you know, assigned person dance in front and then take the lead and then we follow. So you have might have seen this in China, you know, all this kind of there, because the China has a lot of indigenous sports, but Burmese government really forbid our cultural celebration as well. So this kind of thing also changed, you know. So in my family, so that is not so far. Maybe in Myanmar it's already been 1 year, 100 year, but in my family it's still very fresh and very still close. And then now I'm just discovering this womb, so it's very fresh womb for me, and it just feel like I just discovered this like a few years ago back, learning about decolonization. So I grieve and I cry, and there is also, you know, like something you knew that you lost and then you don't know what you lost. So it's also quite quite sad also, you know. The reason that I want to reclaim the kind of effort that I have been making to reclaim my identities and my root is that I am Zaiwa, but I didn't really learn when I was a child, because, you know, like we don't have Zaiwa school, so we never learned how to write Zaiwa literature or language. So I didn't know how to write or read the Zaiwa language, even though I speak daily with my parents or with other people. So while I was in the Netherlands, I learned, you know, through the cultural preservation committee from the KBC. She lives in Mijina, so I learned how to read and write Zaiwa online while I was here. And then I also want to preserve this kind of oral storytelling culture, because back then we didn't have this written form, so our knowledge were passed down through generations, through oral history in terms of storytelling. So I wanted to preserve this kind of our, you know, culture and identity and practices as well, and also not worshipping, you know, how the animism looked like. And I have been trying to contact there's only two family left in my village, but these people are very, very old and very fragile as well. What I call him grandpa, and he's like almost 90 years old, and he is like a dumsa, we call it dumsa, like a dish, the medium, or, you know, like the intermediary between the humans and the not, you know, the spiritual realm. So he know a lot of, you know, this kind of practices, and we call mandan and gata. I don't know how to translate it in English, but it's like specific. For example, like in Christianity, you have a lot of, you know, this kind of saying, or you have to recite, right, to connect to God or this kind of thing. So you know a lot of this kind of knowledge, but he is so old and fragile, and some of them he don't remember anymore. And then there is also healing culture, you know, like they are also like nature healers, so they know medicinal plants and how to heal you, this kind of stuff I wanted to do, but now I'm so far away and only trying to do it online, and online it really sucks as well. And the distance is really making me crazy, and at the same time I can't go back, and at the same time I know that these people are slowly, you know, phasing out and dying out, and it will be completely gone. Like before it's too late, I really want to go back to Burma and Myanmar to, you know, to this kind of work. Yeah, that's my goal.
It's really fascinating, because when you hear about these minority Christian communities in Burma, ethnic Christian communities that are marginalized and that themselves face persecution because of their faith and because of their identity by the majority Bamar Buddhism, and you hear about that, and then as we get further into this nuance, you know, you're then describing another part of this where
another oppression.
Right, exactly, exactly. And that oppression involves the spread over time and space of religion and faith, which is what happens everywhere.
One of the sad things is that, you know, like when the missionary converted the whole Kachin population into Christianity, the way they taught our culture being as a salvagery, uncivilized, you know, the only progress that you will find, you know, is through Christianity. Yeah. So you have to come to the light. You're in the dark age and this kind of stuff. So our ancestors were being kind of, you know, persuaded that way and indoctrinated, you know. And then because like they, as anthropologists, they really study our culture and they decoded, you know, our weak point and strong point. We have very strong kinship, you know. In one village, one chief has all the authority, and then, the, you know, another mountain, another chief, this kind of stuff. So they convert all the chiefs. Then, you know, like the chief has the saying, everyone who doesn't convert into Christianity is being ostracized or pushed aside, pushed out of the village to the, you know, outskirts of the region, and they cannot participate in the community service like funeral or wedding, wedding or other, you know, all the community service. So these two houses, the last strongholds that I mentioned, were also severely ostracized within our community as well, and constantly being, you know, what do you call, evangelized by the pastors from our own village, you know, this kind of stuff happens a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. But then, you know, to make these matters more complicated, you, because there's never any real pure victim or pure aggressor. It's just all different gradations of privilege and of being victimized. And, you know, I've spoken to many Christian, ethnic Christians on this podcast, and they've, some of them, you know, their faith has been a strong part of their identity. They're, although those practices from American missionaries generations ago may not have been so ethical in how they happened, someone born, you know, several generations later into a faith doesn't know that history, and in some ways they could be born to a faith that then becomes very meaningful to them, and that they really absorb themselves in, and that that starts to guide their life, and that means a lot as a spiritual tradition. And then describe how then on top of this, you know, one colonization on top of another, then describe the Bamar military coming and destroying their churches, destroying their crosses, forcibly using labor to build pagodas for, you know, trying to then convert them to Buddhism on top of that. And so it's really, it's one of those questions on one hand of how far back do you go? And then another question of just all the different levels and layers of colonization. And, you know, I, one of my usual responses when, which doesn't get me a lot of friends when I say this, but when I'll hear some of my Bamar friends start to complain about the Bamar treasures and royal objects that have ended up in the London Museum and that have been squandered and taken unethically and illegally from them to be appreciated by others, and how this is kind of an indication of just how much the Bamar have been persecuted and, you know, impacted by the colonial legacy and kind of how bad this colonization is. And so my response to that will be like, well, yeah, that's great. When are you going to return Mahamuni then? And of course they say, oh, that's totally different. And for those that don't know, you know, Mahamuni was the prized Buddha image from Rakhine State. It was the center of Rakhine culture and faith and society. And for generations, Bamar kings were trying to steal it. Let's call it what it is. They're trying to steal it because it was an indication of their spiritual strength and their righteousness as king and everything else. And eventually they did steal it and they brought it forcibly to Mandalay, the place where it used to sit in Rakhine. That pavilion is still there. You could still go to the place in Rakhine where, you know, their treasured Mahamuni used to sit, and they still cry for it. And so there's this double-edged way of looking at it where, you know, never justify the Bamar royal objects that end up in the London Museum, and never justify that. But it's hard to talk about that while also not acknowledging the theft of Mahamuni, which is the exact same thing, really.
I think, like, of course, like those kind of object and sacred places hold dearly in our identity and spirituality. But what Burma people, also Buddhist people, are doing, like, for example, now just recently or a few years ago, in you know Kachin region, one of our sacred place, like Nlong Baran. Nlong Baran translate to rock. Dragon, the rock, you know, on the mountain is like a big ridge forming, and it looks like a serpent. So like this is our sacred place with a lot of our history and identity, and a lot of myths and story come from that. We grew up listening to this kind of stuff. It means really, you know, it's embedded in our identity and in our childhood and, you know, culture. But this Burma people just come and claim the they want to build pagoda and make you know, paint the golden color every nature phenomenon that they see, and then they destroy our that sacred place. They painted the rock into this golden color, and then give the crown as a dragon, and then they start to make a Buddhist place. This is like really, you know, not really nice. That is also not fair. And this is just recent. Yeah, it has been like that for so long. And then when you also say that, how far do we go back, you know? And then, of course, like as from the West, for example, also the Netherlands or America, you know, they colonized a lot of people and around the world, and they had really done this kind of so many things, layers upon layers and layers of, you know, oppression and silencing and you know, completely just what you call obliterating, you know, this world. How far do we go back? I think it depends on the people who have been, you know, brutalized and, you know, abused, how pain, you know. Of course, like, I want to move on. I want to move on to the future. I want to live my life. But, you know, the past doesn't mean that I can just bury it, because the past is still haunting me here right now in the present, you know. Then how can I move on? Of course I want to move on. So like, it's not a matter of how far. And I don't also have like solution, because in Myanmar, we have very complicated relationship with each ethnic groups and also with the Burma. So, but I think the most important thing is like to have open dialogue and not to further perpetrate this kind of, you know, pains and abuses towards each other. I think that would be a starting point, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. So then getting back to your journey, you then went to Burmese public school, as I understand, and were given such high marks there, achieved such high marks that you were able to go to a very good school in Mandalay. And that's where you began to learn English, and you practiced your English by speaking to tourists at Ubane Bridge. Tell us more about that time in your life.
Yeah, because I was like literally, you know, like this ostracized little unnoticeable person that is, you know, bullied by people for being different, for being minority. So my only strength that I found was like, you know, burying myself into the study and really finding excellence in the academy and school. So I had done really in school really well, and I was also the first in my family to pass the matriculation exam with distinctions and also high marks to be able to qualify for the medical school, which is one of, you know, the top 10 schools in university that you can choose in Myanmar according to the marks that you get at the matriculation. So for me, I work really hard and study hard. So of course, I was qualified for dentistry. I didn't want to be a dentist. I wanted to be a doctor, like because in Myanmar, they don't really call they don't really consider dentists as the doctor, you know, something lower than the doctor. Yeah. So I wanted to go to the medical school for to become a doctor, but I was like maybe 20 marks short. So I wasn't qualified for that, and then I eventually chose to become a dentist, and I went to the dentistry school. And then before before matriculation, we have like a gap year, you know, while we are waiting for the admission for the university. So at that time, I went to Yangon, and then I attend the English speaking skill and English, you know, courses. I finished like A2 level, and then I was start of the intermediate, so B1 level, and then I had to go back to Mandalay again for the university. So I was, you know, I didn't finish that. And then in Mandalay, because I get to see, you know, what a glimpse of Yangon, this prosperity look like, and you know, I really wanted to learn English to be able to, you know, uplift my future father or better, you know, really looking up into this. And then I really, you know, do the self-study to learn English by, you know, giving a free guide around Mandalay with my scooter to whatever tourists I can find. Just talking to them, practicing my English, and then not really, you know, I know that dentistry was interesting, but the education system in Myanmar is so terrible and so bored. So unhealthy for your brains and for your mental health. Like you have to, the, you know, reciting this from began from kindergarten until high school, and then I thought in the university it would be finished. Oh my god, it was like a tenfold or maybe 30-fold more loads than the matriculation. Matriculation was 6 subject, and then at the university there was a 9 subject. Can you imagine that you are reciting by heart, you know, about biology of a human body and male anatomy and the, you know, like botany, the 9 subject. Like for one subject I had to memorize by heart by like 30 essay or 40 pages, and it was so unrealistic and so boring, and I wasn't really paying attention to that. And I knew I wanted to get education from the West because I got a glimpse of English, you know, so I was able to look online, Google, and watch YouTube. So I really put myself to learn English.
And you're not just learning the language, but when you're interacting with tourists, you're also getting glimpses or windows into other worlds. So
exactly.
Did you have interactions with particular tourists that really opened your mind to new things?
I think I still remember the couple that were from UK. And they were telling me about their country, you know, at the open bridge. I still remember what color of clothes they were wearing at that time, you know. So I really had this, a big impression about the West, you know. Oh my God, everything about there is so better than us. I want to go there. I want to be like them. So that's where I think like my mind already also kind of, I don't want to sound negative, but, you know, in a way kind of also, you know, dominated in a soft way, you know, with the soft power, because like I also had this, you know, what do you call, since you were about, you know, being a minority, you had this innate inferiority complex, you know, like, I can't use my language the moment I get out of my village, or Zaiwa language, so I had to learn Jingpo to be able to communicate with a lot of people, and then Chinese, and then Burmese, and then that is still not enough, you know, for my life, and then I had to learn English, then, you know, oh, English is now the standard, the formula for my success, so I had to learn, I really had to focus on that, so that's where I get really, I would say, Anglophilia, this kind of thing, you know, really big impression. Everything is good about West.
Right. So then eventually you leave medical school and your journey takes you to Singapore, to Brown University in the US, and then eventually to Netherlands. Tell us about that.
I think like I was studying, and then I studied 3 years. At some point I couldn't really hold up anymore, and my parents also invested a lot of money in that because they had to do the farm work. My mom especially do the pineapple farming and sugar cane and everything she could, you know, do to support me, because she really wanted me to be liberated from this, you know, a mountain life, and what she also considered as a poor, you know, lifestyle. So she really wanted me to be educated and succeed in life. So I had a huge fight with my parents because I love school. And then back then I was trying to find other stuff from the West. You know, I tried to look for the bachelor scholarship, but back then it was very scarce, you know. Mm. People really don't give the scholarship to the bachelor level. Most of them were like social study, you know, this kind of developmental study. Mm. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do arts or other stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was no major for me, so I really looked for, and then at some point I landed this university at the University of the People online degree, which is from the US, and I took the business administration major there, and I was studying, and then once I'm settled there, and then I completely stopped the dentistry, and then I moved to Yangon, and then there I was studying online, and then working as yoga instructor and Zumba instructor, you know, earning my own money so that I don't have to rely on my parents, which is also very uncommon. I was like 21 years old, 22 years old in Myanmar. There was no part-time job, you know, available. But for me, Zumba and yoga instructor was basically part-time job. So I was able to sustain myself. Yeah. Mm.
Wow. Well, so then your first trip out of the country was to Singapore?
Doing that, I also participate in a lot of, you know, leadership training through the embassy in Yangon, from foreign embassy. Mm. And then I got this opportunity to go as a Young Southeast Asian Leadership Initiative that train young people to be, you know, like entrepreneurs and startup founders, or how to start a social enterprise, you know, to do this kind of development in our own country. So I was selected for that program in Singapore, at the Singapore National University. I think I was there for it's a program, so like 6 months, 1 month on site, and then 6 months continuous support, this kind of stuff. Mm. And I was really trying to find my way, and actually I feel quite established in Yangon just within a few years, and I had a lot of connection. And then after that, I had my yoga studio, and then running yoga retreat with teacher training, inviting the teacher, international teacher, because back then yoga was not a thing in Myanmar at all. Yeah. So I was inviting, you know, the teacher from the West, or, you know, from other country, from India, to host the teacher training to really, you know, teach the people how to become teachers in Myanmar. So I was doing this kind of stuff. So
what years was this?
2018.
Mm, so transition.
17, 18.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah. I remember that time because I lived in Myanmar from 07. So, you know, I saw really many years before the transition began. And then once the transition started, as new ideas started to come, and there were so many new ideas and new things and concepts that started to come to Myanmar during that time. I mean, anything from, you know, kombucha to...
A lot of Western, you know, investment came in, a lot of opportunity, and I was... By then, already speak fluent English, so I was able to connect with, you know, other NGO people and experts. So my circle was around that as well.
Yeah, that was a good time to be able to not just to have the freedom and the safety to do something in Myanmar, but also to have the access of those people coming in and the community that can take part. But I remember in the transition year starting to see the very first yoga studios going up and doing like in yoga, you know, classes for yoga, and being like, wow, this is really changing. And wasn't it, you know, the famous video of the coup and the aerobics instructor? Was it Zumba?
That was Zumba. Yeah.
Do you know her?
I don't know her, but those were later than us. That lady, you know. Mm. So Zumba kind of started. I think like I was not the first person. There was one person, the first one in Myanmar. And then our batch was the first Zumba instructor in Myanmar, conducted in Myanmar by this official, you know, teachers from the Zumba organization.
Right.
So... I was really involved in the Zumba movement and yoga movement in Myanmar. You know, now it's very popular, you know, from the very beginning.
Yeah. I see. As an artist, as someone with an artistic perspective and looking for kind of themes, and as someone who's also been involved in Zumba and, of course, knowing military oppression, putting all this together, when you saw that video, was there a certain lens you saw that through, or a certain kind of like metaphorical or deeper meaning of the juxtaposition of the woman doing Zumba and the coup happening, you know, launching right behind her?
I think like that video was quite viral, and then like we have, I think like during that COVID era, that was COVID era, right? Okay, I already loved the country by then. So I didn't have contact with this lady and people, but you know, that's how they teach, you know, their students, or some of them just took their own videos to, you know, post online and share the dance routine online or yoga routine online. Yeah. That's what they do. And in the video, what we all know, that, you know, the military convoy behind going on. So for me, this is quite funny and course, also unserious at the same time. Yeah. So, you know, like that turned our whole life and our whole country upside down. Mm-hmm. So for me, now when you mentioned that, it's kind of funny because I was involved in the Zumba from the early, you know, in Myanmar, and then now it's going on. So I don't know, it's just kind of part of being history or something like that,
There's something about it to me that's this, these juxtapositions, you know, the juxtaposition of a single lone feminine woman doing a modern technique, standing alone with the masculine, militarized, armed soldiers bringing the country back to the dark ages as her Zumba and kind of, you know, you could almost say liberation and her movements are living in the new Myanmar, and this and this this convoy that's going behind her is dragging her and the rest of the country into the past. I mean, there's something, you know, strangely metaphorical there that I think is still left to be interpreted and
the contrast is quite stark, right? And she was also wearing a mask,
right?
And the COVID and everything,
Right. So then, you know, you're in the transition doing yoga, your English is getting better, you're using the opportunities available to you, and then start to get interested, I assume, in film at this time? That's what ultimately brings you out?
No, like, I think, like, I have, if I have to shamelessly say, because, like, growing up as a minority and having to make myself all the time invisible, you know, to avoid bullying and other stuff, and also hide myself in the closet, so I've kind of felt, like, very unseen, you know. So I always wanted to be popular or this kind of stuff. You know? I wanted to be actor. So I was really trying to get into that acting career in Myanmar as well. Of course, in Myanmar is the Burma dominated country. Then as myself with Kachin person, when we speak Burmese language and we have very strong accents. So in the TV and in the movie, you cannot cast somebody with the accent. You have to speak Burmese fluently without accent. So I was not able to do that. So for me, that was out of the question and not possible. I was trying to still find outside Burma, but also didn't work out. And I still even try when I arrived in Amsterdam, but I, at some point I realized that this is nothing for me. So I'm more into creative, you know, from behind the scenes and doing this kind of stuff. So while I was in Yangon, I was at the time, it was a transition, democracy, and the world knew Myanmar as a safe country, and tourism was also booming. But in my region, there was a lot of, you know, civil conflict going on. They started with, you know, two teachers, our volunteer teacher, Burmese military, kill two of our Kachin volunteer teacher. That's when they started the war in 2011. So we never had actually peace movement in our region. So I know the transition began in 2012, but we never had it, you know. So a lot of refugee in my region, my relatives, and my mother, my parents are also, you know, on the run again to the China, to our relatives. So even though I moved to Yangon and Mandalay to avoid the conflict there and to also avoid conscription from KIA, So I was also, you know, trying to enjoy the opportunity, what is mm-hmm. there. But I was not also enjoying it. At the same time, I knew that my people were dying and the humanitarian aid were being blocked, like 100,000 people trapped mm-hmm. using as a human shield. So mm-hmm. I was also involved in this kind of, you know, humanitarian aid and with other activists. That's when I, you know, really get to face-to-face in contact with the military and the police as well in Yangon. Yeah.
How so?
Because I was doing a lot of, you know, fundraising event through yoga or through events mm. or through Zumba. Mm. And then we donate the money to the Kachin IDPs. Mm-hmm. And then we were also trying to do media awareness campaign with other activists. And then our events were cracked down. Hotel managers arrested, and the rest of the activists were also tracked, you know, chased after. Mm-hmm. And I was there to participate as a presenter. I was also doing as a master of ceremony. Mm-hmm. And then luckily, I also escaped. So that's when I know that, oh, I'm not also safe here, you know. So like, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I wasn't safe in Kachin, and then mm-hmm. now I'm not safe in Myanmar, Yangon anymore. So like, that's when I really start to question about my future. Yeah?
I think this is really important to emphasize, because this is one part of all of those years, because everything was so complicated and so much was happening that sometimes isn't as focused on or understood. And that's that, you know, I think there's a wide understanding of people, of both Burmese living through that time and outsiders, that the Rohingya crisis was in full flame. And whatever you want to say about the transition period, that the Rohingya did not benefit from the transition years. It was an absolute nightmare for them. And I think that is well known and documented. That would surprise few people. But some of the other ethnics outside of the Kachin have also talked about how, although the benefits didn't come to them quite in the same flow as it did to Bamar, life did get better for them. We've spoken to many.
Well, they were enjoying, you know, like a full fruits of this Western aid, a lot of, you know, foreign aid and also investment and a lot of opportunity. Yeah. But I remember, because like when we said democracy, we ethnic people never really had it, and we really don't know what it is, you know. Yeah. So I remember Aung San Suu Kyi came to Kachin State to, you know, do for her voting campaign, wearing beautiful Kachin dress. Oh, you know, like, we have the history connection mm-hmm. together. My father and you were also allies, so mm-hmm. I'm the daughter, I will fulfill the promise, and sure. this kind of stuff. She came to our Kachin State, and then I was in the matriculation exam. So I was in the, you know, boarding school. I was not allowed to go out. Mm-hmm. But I was so drawn to Aung San Suu Kyi's mm-hmm. aura. Oh my God. People from all over the world yeah. come to see her, because she is the only Nobel Peace Prize winner. Yeah. And I want to admire her, I want to see her. Yeah. I sneak out of the boarding school, and then I went to see her and went to listen to her speech about, you know, her plan about our ethnic city and our people and our region. Yeah. I was so impressed and so admired by her. And then when I went back to the boarding school, my teacher awaited me with this long cane, and then at the door. And then, like, she, you know, covered my legs mm-hmm. and then beat the heck out of me mm-hmm. on my calves mm-hmm. and then, like, mm-hmm. big marks, you know. Mm-hmm. I very remember about my encounter with Aung San Suu Kyi mm-hmm. and very hopeful. And I thought, oh, the pain was worth it, you know. And then mm-hmm. when she won the election, nothing happened. Mm-hmm. She never mentioned about our people anymore. And then not just our people, yeah, our people were the first to suffer. And then there's Rohingya happened again. Yeah. She never mentioned about them as well. So like, that's when I start to have doubt over her as well. And she's just another Bama, you know?
Yeah, right. But my point is that during those transition years, the atrocities of the Rohingya were well documented. The benefits of the transition, uneven as they were also documented. But what is lesser known is that things were flaring up in Kachin State, mm-hmm. and things were really, really bad
exactly.
in Kachin. Yeah. And that's something we have to remember. And so, and what I really want to underscore in what you're saying here is that you're saying that in as late as, you know, during the transition years, that you as a Kachin, you know, entrepreneur, student, involved in the international community, activist, etc., that long before the coup, years before the coup, you felt unsafe. I mean, you felt unsafe to an extent that you couldn't be in downtown Yangon and just live and do your work and your schooling. And so I think this is, and this is just something I really want to be underscoring, because we hear people say this after 2021. Many people say this after 2021, and there's so much evidence that the documentation that people know of why they felt unsafe. And we also know about the Rohingya tragedies as well. But you, as a as an educated, entrepreneurial Kachin international, you know, with an international understanding now, you did not feel safe in Yangon years before the coup happened. And so I think this is important to be able to draw attention to. And so then realizing that you were not safe, you had to get out. And I assume that's where the Netherlands Film School played
true.
A role.
That what you said is true, because like the word we have in Zaiwa language is called Mianpang. We don't have specific words in our language vocabulary. It translate Mianpang really translate mean running away from Burmese soldier. So this only happened during the you know, Japanese colonial, and then Burmese people came to our region to do more oppression and you know, set up their camp. So they really torture my grandma. So when I grew up, my grandmas and my parents told me about how brutal the Burmese military were towards the women, and killing all the men and shooting all the livestock for their rations, and then taking the young people for as a porter, and then raping women, burning the children, the village. This, their tactic has been the same all the time. So I grew up listening to this kind of story, and then I couldn't relate to it, because now I had never heard what the gun sounds like, you know, quite until I was to my whole life. And when this kind of grandma's story grandma told me, then I used to laugh. And then in 2011, the first time in our life, that was, you know, like, oh, this is the first time that I understand the meaning of Mianpang, you know, running away from Burmese military. That's when we had to evacuate to China from our village. So this kind of stuff. And in the Kachin, if you ask any Kachin person that from the Kachin region, we were never safe, and we were never really, you know, like, don't know the light or the fruits or the taste of democracy. Only people who are lucky enough or well up enough to be able to send their children to Yangon. Like, I had no relatives in Yangon, you know, so it was for me, being homeless in Yangon, you know, the first year was quite rough, you know, so, but it's a collective trauma for us, for the Kachin people, but probably Burmese people don't know then. And back then when I was in school, I had to keep low profile, because I don't want my Burmese peers people to know about my father being in the KIA, because in the KIA region, every family has to sub one member in the KIA military. So like, my father was back then in the military, and I had to keep myself low profile from my peers, because like, back then they call us rebels, you know, rebels who, you know, lawlessly robbed the civilians at gunpoint for, you know, asking money, this kind of stuff. A lot of, you know, derogative terms or
terrorists
thrown around. So I also had to keep my identity secrets among my Burmese people, even while I was living in Yangon.
So, I mean, you have this burden of the KIA demanding that a male family member join them, and then you have a burden on which you don't have a choice with, but then you have a burden on top of that, that then your family member has been forced to join a militarized organization, which then is labeled by the majority population as a terrorist organization. And so really, you're just, anywhere you turn, you're being you're kind of being subsumed in the forces greater than yourself.
I think for me, because the Kachin people and KIA is very just like KBC, one identity, you know, because we believe in the freedom and independence from the Burma people and Burmese oppression, military oppression. So like, I wouldn't say forced, you know, conscription, but it is our also willingness to serve in the KIA for our independence, to protect our land, you know, to protect the abuses and raped and tortured, this kind of thing. Everybody wanted to serve. But for me, as a gay person and also like someone excel in academic and education and in arts, it is not used for me to hold a gun. So it was just not suitable for me. So I had to leave. But I had two elder brothers. When my father left the KIA, I had two elder brothers. They also joined, you know, one after another. One family member has to be active all the time. So like they all went through it. But for me, I had no place in that military. So
Right. And I think one of the questions that some people have today looking at Myanmar as we look at this hope for a greater federal democracy that is trying to be created is the question of these different ethnic groups, communities, EAOs, EROs, how many of them are actually holding democratic values themselves? And so looking at the Kachin, Kachin community, the KAA, however you want to look at that, to what degree are you seeing that democracy is a real value among this group?
For me, I'm more interested in, you know, like humanitarian aid and this kind of activist about human rights. You know, I didn't really study, so I couldn't really keep you like academic scholar inside, but I have lived experience, you know, our collective memory. When I say I do none, I just don't say about myself. In my culture, I carry the weight of my family, my kinship, my people and my community, our whole Kachin society. This is how we collective, you know, society and our culture work. So like we have collective burden and responsibility and trauma as well. So I can tell only from my experience. Yeah. In every Kachin you ask, like for us, the sentiment is very strong because every time, you know, since from Banglong, the betrayal, you know, and then never happened, and then they, you know, take on ownership of our land and Chiang Mai, and then without consulting our people and who lived there for generations, you know, this is our land, this is our home, and then suddenly they want to erect this ginormous dam without our consulting with us, you know, so. We were never included in the conversation. Mm-hmm. We were just being treated as, you know, I don't know what they were thinking, you know, like we were never in the radar, I guess, like they just thought we were part of them or something like that. But we never feel that we are part of Burma people or Burma community, you know. So when now I'm going around international, you know, doing that, because Burma people has done Burmanization so much. Our national costume is the Burma traditional costume, not my. That has nothing to do with me and my culture or my people. Also in the school history, all the heroes were Anarita Bandula, all this Burmese, you know, like a sanitized version of themselves and glorified version of themselves. We were excluded. Our names never occur in the history book, in the school curriculum. So we were always excluded. And we know that we have been treated unfairly. So like, I really don't, even though we share the same country and other outsiders see us as a collective, but we don't really feel that way, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, understandable, right? So then because of your own lack of safety, you realize you have to leave during the transition period, years before the coup. And you come to the Netherlands. Tell us about that transition.
That was also a whole tragic story and very traumatizing for me as well. Because like the Netherlands or the West and the UN recognized Myanmar as a transitioning democratic country and it's a safe country. When I come with this being unsafe as a indigenous person, as an ethnic minority in the Netherlands, and they couldn't believe it in the Netherlands. Like the Dutch immigration officers just told me, you are safe in Myanmar. If you are not safe in Kachin, you can go to Yangon. If you are not safe in Yangon, then you can go to Mandalay. We don't believe you. So like I was telling about my, you know, struggles and my unsafety. They didn't believe it. So they reject my asylum here. And it's not just like, hey, reject and you go back. The process took like 8 months and 1 year. And then you know that you have been rejected and then deportation process begin. And then you have to wait another 6 months. I was I was depressed in the refugee camp here in the Netherlands, and I lost hope in humanity because I have every right to claim myself refugee and for my safety as an indigenous person, as a minority, as a Christian, as a gay person. You know, I checked all the human right refugee list, but I was still not believed, and they tried to deport me, and I thought, oh, democracy is not real, and so I really lost hope, and then I was depressed in the refugee camp, and I was about to get deported, and then the COVID-19 happened, and then my flight was canceled, and I was stranded in Netherlands again, and then I ran away from deportation camp, and by then I was already 2 years in the Netherlands, and then I met already, you know, like Kachin community here. We also have church here, so I was taken in by one of the family here, and all of rather I live undocumented here in the Netherlands for 1 year, so that I can, you know, be able to reapply for the asylum again. So for me, going back was not an option, but I thought like, okay. But in the refugee camp, there were so many human rights abuses and negligence happened. I don't want to talk bad things about the Netherlands. You know, I'm grateful that I am safe here now, but things can be still very improved here as well. You know, now we're very polarized, political right-wing agenda with a lot of stigmas about immigrants and refugees as well. So a lot of human rights abuses happened, and in the refugee camp that we were given the number, we were not called by our name. We had to do fingerprint report. We were treated like criminals. You know, I had never been in a prison in Myanmar, and what I know from my memory, police mean danger, run away. When I first saw the police here in the Netherlands, the Dutch police were so tall, with so full of gears and, you know, this kind of guns and batons and equipment. I was so scared and really traumatized, you know. And I was put in the prison and this kind of stuff, in the detention center. I was really traumatized, and this kind of human rights that are not acceptable just because I'm refugee, you know, like I don't really get to be treated with respect and dignity like the rest of the people or the citizen here. So like that's when I knew that I wanted to tell my story to the people, because I thought we were being put away in the refugee camp out of sight from the people, public knowledge. I thought the public doesn't really know what's going on inside the camp. So that's when I started to write article, trying to write on the voice of refugee on Twitter. It didn't work out. I tried to contact Dutch media. Nobody showed interest because I have very limited perception about the public perception of refugee here, you know. So I thought they didn't know, but so I thought by sharing my story and other people's story and the, you know, sufferings, that other people might care, but nobody cared. And that's when I started to document everything in diary, in my journal, and in my phone, collect evidence. And that's when I know that I want to be a documentary filmmaker, and I want to make a documentary about this, you know, unfairness and unjustness. So I was looking, I was trying to do everything literally in my power to connect to producers so that I could, might be able to, you know, make a documentary about this. Or I took the rule of, you know, citizen journalists, and I interviewed so many Syrian refugee or Middle Eastern refugee from Africa, from everywhere, you know, about LGBT, and I collected interview and this kind of stuff. But yeah, that's how I, my journey with the arts and, you know, active. I didn't know that I was activist, you know, as a Kachin person, as a collective culture, we just share responsibility when our brothers are in pain or when another human is in pain. You have to help, you know. This, I didn't know myself as activist, you know, but when I arrive here, then I get to discover the word activist and what it means, and, you know, so that's how it started.
So then as you started to go deeper into those stories of those from Syria, from Middle East, from Africa, as you mentioned, and start to learn who they were and what they were escaping, did that put in context a little bit about where you as a Kachin came from in Myanmar?
I think I did interview those people, but you know, I was totally unaware of, you know, outside. I, of course, I grew up with Burmese education, very, you know, like indoctrinating study, you know, very basic, you know, other outside world contact, and I didn't know where the Syria was. I didn't even know where the Netherlands is like before I was forced to, you know, put my, you know, a life here in in the Netherlands at the skateboard at the airport. So I didn't know that much about, I didn't know about geopolitics, or I didn't know what language was even spoken here in the Netherlands. So when I asked those people, their journeys are even more treacherous than mine, because I didn't have to cross the desert and the sea, start myself on the boat without water and Russian, you know, to make it to the Europe. So their journey were more or less the same, but at the same time, it's so horrifying. Some of them were minors, you know, without parents, and because they were unsafe in their country. And of course, they don't really tell what's going on, you know, in detail, but they talk about their personal experience, you know, of the journey. It's so traumatizing. And yeah, it was really quite a moment and profound moment in my life that everything changed completely upside down, you know, pulled away from my roots and from my comforts and everything I have known and everything I'm familiar with, you know.
And so then you also had to learn another language on top of this after all your prior language study, and you learned Dutch. How was that?
Dutch, for me, I spent 3 years in a refugee camp. In the refugee camp back then, we were not allowed to study. We were not allowed to work. So we were given like 50 euros per week for a meager ration to get by per week. So we were allowed to do nothing. And then, of course, they did provide like basic language course, the Dutch language course at the refugee camp with some Dutch pensioners, you know, who are poor, you know, in their life. So they come to volunteer to teach refugees some basic Dutch. And then I knew that I speak already five languages, you know, why should I learn this very unknown little language, you know, country language? I already speak international language, English, which is, you know, I don't want to learn the Dutch. And I had no motivation to learn the Dutch language because it's only spoken here. And of course, you can speak in Caribbean and Suriname. What am I going to do there? I'm not going to go there, you know. So I was not motivated to learn there. At the same time, that you don't know that you will be given permit or not. So you were kind of living in this uncertain limbo periods, what the future is gonna hold, where you're gonna get deported or, you know, put into detention. So in this heightened fear of state, you know, so you can't do really anything. That's also when I dropped out my, you know, business administration study online. I was not able to concentrate anymore and really sunken into depression. So I was not motivated to learn the Dutch in the camp. But now I regret it a little bit because after I got permit, I really had to force myself to learn the language because I, of course, like why I was in the procedure, the coup happened and no Myanmar citizen were able to go back, and then by automatically, you know, I was given the granted this residence here. And as soon as I was granted here, I started to really focus on my future, you know, how what to do in this foreign land. So I really took the time what I'm really interested in. So I'm artist, you know, I'm gonna be a documentary filmmaker. So, but in the Netherlands, because it is the Dutch spoken country, and the study are all in Dutch for this kind of specialization. So I had to force myself to learn the language in a very short period to reach to B2 level. And for me, I speak all this, you know, Asian language, which are from the same family with the same grammar structure. And English is the Germanic language, but with the Dutch, it's still very different, you know. The Dutch, they put the verb in the at the end of the sentence. So for me, I feel like speaking backward or, you know, in fragments, you know. But because I really wanted to make documentary about, especially to represent my stories, my people's story, marginalized people, and, you know, like this kind of unheard and unseen society and the voices, you know, I want to channel. So I really took the motivation and forced myself to learn within a very short period of time. So I kind of had the trauma, like when I hear the Dutch language, my system just revolves, you know, push out so much, and at some point I want to puke when I when I hear the Dutch language, yeah.
And then now that you're living in more relative safety and freedom in the Netherlands after a very traumatic experience with the COVID and the coup and the refugee status, what is, how would you characterize your experience of now living in the Netherlands?
I think like, yeah, it sounds like, you know, like free and sounds and safe, you know, but in reality that every day is still a struggle and a battle for me. I still have to fight for my space. I still have to fight for my, you know, voice and for my people. And then now in Myanmar, Myanmar has never been, you know, any period of peace, you know, since after the coup, a series of disaster. And I'm constantly, you know, like, bothered by that. I lost my friend in the front line, constantly bombarded with this, you know, negative news, not just normal negative, you know, I lost my friends, best friend, and my family members and all this kind of thing, you know. So I was constantly busy and having to live with this, you know, dual reality that at the same time you are living in this safe and prosperous West, at the same time you are still half of your identity is there, you know, like you are dealing with this reality. And my peers, my colleagues, my work colleagues has no idea what I'm going through, you know. I had to mask myself. Okay, I just had my nephew pass away. I cry, I wipe away my tear and then go to work and smile and force myself to fulfill my duty here. So, and it's still a struggle, you know, like, of course, like, I'm also a minority here, you know, where not just now a minority, you know, I'm a minority in Burma, but I still look like Burmese, Asian, you know, but now I'm here very visible minority. And also when I speak Dutch and very heavy accent. So, yeah, sometimes it's quite lonely and it's every day feels like quite an uphill battle or something like that. Yeah.
I see. And after the journey you've taken of accepting and then coming out with your sexual orientation, you are in a country where it's at least it's legal to be gay and it's recognized. And I assume in a place like Amsterdam, it's pretty socially accepted. But where are you with your identity with that?
At the moment, I'm very, very comfortable. You know, I came out, I think, like, almost two years ago now, socially, to my parents and also on social media. I do a lot of blogging, you know, because I always have this sedana. I don't know how to translate this in English. Sedana is the will, goodwill to help people. So whatever I see in the West and whatever I learn in the West, I really want to rechannel that to my people. So I always do this kind of educational blogs and people know me there. And then when I came out, and it was quite a shock for them. And also, like, for me, I was able to come out after, like, almost 4 years, you know, in the Netherlands. Because the whole time I had to hide myself and a whole set of inner crisis and identity crisis going on with the inner conflicts of, you know, being brought up super religious and Christian value, and then like being gay and then now open up, you know, I feel like my whole existence and my being is just a sin, you know. So this kind of guilt and conflict, and this was also one of the depression, you know. I went through this EMDR therapy about my childhood and all this kind of stuff. So after I finished the therapy, I was more stable. And then I know that when I was young, because of this, you know, my sexual orientation, I also considered, you know, hurting myself and suicide. So I knew on social media, now Facebook is very widespread, you know. In Myanmar, a lot of children and kids still, you know, go through this kind of thing. So I don't want them to go through what I went through when I was a child. I had nobody to look up to, you know. to look up as a role model. Nobody was there to tell me, so I wanted to really help these people, not for the, you know, all the bigger that people or Christians, you know, but for the people, for the children. So for me, I'm quite comfortable, and I also take myself, you know, the role on as an activist and also LGBT activist, you know.
Yeah. As you tap into Amsterdam's LGBT community, which must be very robust and active, mm-hmm. Within here in Amsterdam, are there connections or lessons or insights that you've learned from how they're doing things and how they're owning their own identity and integrating into society that you want to take and bring back to Myanmar eventually?
Mm-hmm. I think what I usually tell people in my blog is that because in my country, the education is not science-based and not mm-hmm. fact-based, right? People believe that sexuality and sexual orientation is just a hoax, or, you know, like you pick up it as a trend, you know, mm-hmm. or you are just, you know, like, what do you call, following after your feeling, you know, doing the sin. And people assume that it can be corrected, it can be changed through prayers or through, you know, self-decision. Mm-hmm. But this kind of, you know, I'm very scientific. And so I really want, I always tell people and children and people, young people, you know, these are, you know, science or biology. You can, you know, go around that, you know, either you are that or that, you know, human sexual spectrum. Of course, the gay culture, the Amsterdam is very different. The West, you know, the Western gay culture, the relationship dynamic, and those are very different from Myanmar society and Myanmar values and there. So I wouldn't necessarily show everything, you know, to the Myanmar community, because it's horrifying and unacceptable and morally, you know, yeah. unacceptable. So when I first arrived here, I was also very shocked, you know. Mm-hmm. For example, at the gay bar, there's, I don't know, maybe you can also get a little bit of gay education here, like, you know, the cruising area. It's like a dark room, like the bar is on the first floor, and then the basement is cruising area. In the dark room, like, people just go there and meet each other and have sex in front of other people while other people are watching. And those kind of so open, and it really shocked me to the system, to my system. At the same time, I was struggling with my own, you know, Christian value and identity stuff. And not just at the bar, and then also outdoor, there's a cruising area, specific area at the beach, you know, so open. For me, it was like too much, and a kind of shock, you know, mm-hmm. a culture shock, and the value, you know, like, people just, sex is just so available and so casual here. In Myanmar, it's not like that, you know. We value about monogamy and, you know, like, loyalty and this kind of, you know, but it's very completely different here. So I don't want to, you know, influence this kind of what I find untasteful to Myanmar people. But, you know, because now internet is also very, you know, accessible to everyone. Sometimes people, really, Myanmar people really looked up to Western ideals of this kind of unwanted behavior. For example, girls wearing shorts and showing, you know, like, body parts. Mm. That in the West, I feel like they categorize, you know, like, sexual freedom as the ultimate liberation, you know, freedom and this kind of thing. But you can be moderate and, you know, adopt other different value. And but I myself have been there, being very influenced by the West and looking up to, because everything was so behind the world and behind the, you know, standard or the modernity. So I wanted to mimic the Westerners. I wanted to be like them, you know. But when I arrived here, then I get to see the culture, what we have there is valuable, and what we have, they have here, what can we learn each other, you know. So neither culture is perfect 100%. So, like, if we really learn, you know, mindfully adopt other people's culture and take their rules, you know, the standards, that is also compatible for our culture and for our context, without erasing ourselves, because, you know, we have inferiority complex. Everything the Westerner do must be good, so we want to mimic them. So the girls started to wear short skirt. I mean, like, wearing is, you know, like, not a bad thing, but you can wear it, but you also don't, what do you call, devalue your own culture and identity. Don't think the Western is the ultimate, you know, ideal. Yeah. I don't want people to adopt the Western ideal in that sense, you know. So, of course, the science, you know, sexuality, sexual orientation, these are facts, you know, like, I want to educate those kind. So, there is for me. I feel like I want to take the role on, you know, being a cultural bridge. Nobody assigned me this role. As an activist, nobody paid me a lot of my time and energy, emotion and depression and this kind of thing. I just this urge did give me also energy, but at the same time give me so much burden and, you know, mental pressure. So
And you're doing that with, you know, you mentioned your blog, you also have a YouTube channel, you do like kind of short TikTok style videos. And so there's the documentary is a big project that you're working on that will take a lot of work and time in order to get it out, but you're doing all of these small touches and social media of trying to be this cultural bridge, both of talking to Dutch and Europeans and Westerners about the immigrant experience, the Kachin experience, the Burmese experience here, as well as talking to your Kachin and Burmese community back home about what it's like coming from there to be here. And so what's been your experience in managing these different social media channels?
Social media channel, okay. For me, like, you know, like I told you, the ultimate inferiority complex, you know, not being heard and not being seen. I always wanted to let our people's story out, my story out to the world, you know, the world when I literally went back then, literally, I mean, to the West, you know, to be in the spotlight, global spotlight. So I was really trying to find a way, you know, because like Kachin people were trapped in Michina and Waimor, nobody wrote, no Western media wrote about us. So I also tried that. I also thought I wanted to be a journalist so that I can write those reports, you know. So I was constantly trying to find a medium where I can express myself and my people's story, not just my people, but any minority, you know. And of course, I came to the West to represent my people and my country because nobody knows where Myanmar is, you know. So, but now I'm in the West, now in the Netherlands, and I had to take on this another role and responsibility of showing the Dutch population about what the immigration process and kind of integration trauma, you know, or forced assimilation look like, this kind of stuff. So one more responsibility added, you know, and then another decolonization, activism, this kind of more and more responsibility. And then back to your question about the social medias, like, for me, like you said, the documentary, it takes a long process, you know, like one project took 2 years, 3 years. So it's very long, you know, just like academic research and, you know, this kind of thing. So by the time you produce, sometimes it could be already irrelevant anymore. Then, you know, like TikTok, social media, everybody now use social media and very, you know, everybody literally watches. So there is a gap, you know, between the filmmakers and academics and the publics. And, you know, there's a huge gap in between. So like, I really want to also bridge the, you know, the gap also. And also like the academic setting, of course, you and I, we other people who understand English can have access to and listen to this kind of podcast. Yeah. But the 90% of the population in Myanmar don't understand English. Yeah. Then, you know, like, then how can I reach to these people in a way that they understand it, you know? And then now I'm also trying to make a rare art mineral project in Kachin State. I had to read a lot of reports. So dry and detailed with so many fancy words, you know, and nobody understand and nobody reads, you know, no normal citizen would understand. So I am kind of also reading this kind of thing and then translating it, you know, into film that everybody understands. So this is also my goal and what is also I'm trying to do and doing at the moment. And there is also a gap, like with the film, I need like 10 grand, so, you know, this kind of euros for one film, you know, a lot of budget and crews, and you can make every story and topic very fast out to the people. And then when I have urgent something to tell, like fundraising about Myanmar earthquake, it was to went to social media very fast, and then boom, 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 the fund came in. And so for me, it is very, very effective for me. And I'm also very happy that I do that. I can just express myself freely about my stupid idea or my, you know, everything. That if you like, you can come and watch. And, you know, if you don't, you can skip. So for me, that what I can express in the film, I can express it in short content form. Yeah.
Great. Well, I thank you so much for coming on here to share your journey and talk through all of these different fascinating themes, all of these fascinating themes that your life has revolved around, and to share your story.
I am not academic scholars, but, you know, I hope they can find, you know, resonate and relatability to my story. And for me, like, what we haven't talked about is, like, also here about decolonization, you know, decolonizing identity, this kind of thing. But we can, you know, have another space, probably another time, or not here, that's also fine. But this is also currently I'm trying to do for my people. I think it will be a very long story. I think, like, about the activists, you know, maybe more relevant to talk about Myanmar diasporas, you know, in the West, and also as an activist here, how we are, you know, navigating in the West, because Myanmar people think that we are already in paradise. At the same time, we are, you know, this kind of thing. So, but anyway, I'm really glad that, you know, you give me this platform and invite me to your platform to share my personal story. So I'm really grateful.
Sure. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and joining our global community of listeners. Here at Insight Myanmar Podcast, we see our platform as a space where stories, reflections, and experiences come together to create deeper understanding and foster meaningful connections. Each conversation is an invitation to strengthen the ties that reveal our shared humanity, which is grounded in a sense of care towards Myanmar and its people. And this work is made possible only through the generosity and support of listeners like you. Your contributions enable us to continue amplifying these voices, sharing these important stories, and connecting us all through the power of dialogue. And so by giving, you're not just supporting a production, you're actively nurturing a growing community of insight and compassion. So if you found value in what we share, we invite you to help us sustain and expand this platform. Every donation, no matter the size, helps us to keep this effort alive. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to make a contribution and be a part of the shared journey. Yaran nangka yau nyana dadu ya dalam dia di ganeza de mana we kada besa yana besa yo hoba yaran nanda daya nangana yaran ya daya nang poda ba yaran nang